Gary Kay's Almost Daily Rants and Raves.
The Week.
The Women in AV Wavecast. Green AV.
Good morning, Rave listeners, and welcome to The Week on Rave Radio. I'm Joel Rollins. The Week is brought to you by Mitsubishi, makers of high-quality monitors, projectors, and lots of accessories for the audiovisual industry. You can find out more about that at Mitsubishi.com. In the news for the week for the world of AV and electronics are a number of things I'd like to talk about. First of all, Sony's release of their new compact professional 4K projector, the VPL GT100. This projector is targeted right at small simulations, flight simulators, virtual training. The resolution is 4096 by 2160, or 8.8 megapixels, in a very compact case based on Sony's SXRD technology. This projector's gotten panned a bit by the industry press as it came out about 2 weeks ago, mostly for its 2,000 lumen output. Personally, I think they hit the nail on the head. Most simulation screens are small, and they're used in very controllable light situations, and I think the dual inputs and native resolution are going to save me from the tedious process of matching projectors for some simulation situations. Of course, it remains to be seen how well Sony markets this product. Also in the news, as you might see in Gary's blog, was a product called Twine. Twine is a little rubberized block that contains a number of sensors and an 802.11 interface. It's touted by its creators as the way to get the objects in your life talking to you via the internet. It features an internal temperature sensor, an orientation sensor, an accelerometer, a magnetic switch, a moisture sensor, and a breakout system for wiring other sensors to it. It's reputedly very easily programmed and can email, tweet, or issue HTTP strings when programmed conditions are met. Personally, I think it helps spell out the path to decentralized control systems, so I'll be watching this one. Lastly, a pair of news items from the world of consumer electronics. First, the news that the tablet computer has now outpaced the notebook in both sales and in distribution quantity, and will soon outpace all personal computers combined. Also, a great number of tablets, for the first time, will not be tethered to a desktop PC, but will be the user's only computer. Does this spell a major change in how we'll use computers in the future? Personally, I think it already does. The last item that caught my eye this morning was the news of Google's Code-In contest for 13 to 17-year-olds. It's pretty obvious that if we want to set students up to be creators of technology and not just passive consumers, they have to learn to code. But while there are individual teachers helping kids learn the nuts and bolts of programming, most American students today know zilch about computer science. So how could they win a computer science contest if they've never even heard the phrase open source? Look no further than Google's third annual Code-In, a global contest for 13 to 17-year-olds interested in learning more about computer science and open source software development. The Google news begs a big question. Is education facilitating a new generation of kids as creators rather than as users? And if so, how? With me this morning is Bill Waldman, Director of Technology at King Lo Haywood Thomas School, one of the nation's top private schools. Bill is a technology evangelist who's involved in helping bring technology to the classroom in a number of innovative ways. Good morning, Bill. Welcome to The Week.
That's quite an introduction.
Let me open up with a broad question. Are kids ready for that Google contest?
Here's my theory. To some degree, there's an element of the population that has this in their DNA. For those kids, you can't beat them off with a stick. They're coming for you anyway. They're coming for you without the Google contest. They're just interested, and it's in their nature. But that is a very small component. Not that, you know, Google has a large grasp, and this is an international thing. So it won't be like they'll be embarrassed and there'll be nobody participating. Yeah, the real issue for me is that during my time in private and public school education in the last 20-plus years, we have kind of created a very artificial environment in schools where learning computer science in schools isn't really learning anything really remotely resembling what you do with computers both, you know, at a higher level in college or even, you know, even with computers in on a practical level like you do in your business or I do in mine. But that's really not what's interesting to a kid and is going to get them into that field and involve them in that field and keep them involved to the point where they can actually appreciate and really learn that stuff. it isn't a good entry point, and it isn't even interesting at their level.
Speaking of an entry point, we were talking earlier, I did a blog post last week about my first involvement in electronics, which was a crystal radio kit. And I got a lot of response to that blog post, including from people who thought it was a great idea, people who said they wouldn't know where to get one anymore, and people who said you couldn't give those to kids now because we can no longer give kids dangerous toys. I took a look on the market and I realized that many of the toys that you and I grew up with simply are no longer available because of that. When I was a kid, my toys were hammers and nails and a soldering iron at age 8. Can that be done anymore, or is that gone?
Well, I think actually there is more opportunity, really, than ever to do similar things. I have a similar experience. When I was a kid, I also had a soldering iron. I also had access to kits, and some of these kits really did have truly dangerous stuff in them. So there was a different sensibility. But thank God, they're not outlawed. You can get them. You can do what you want with them. You have to be very responsible with this stuff. But you can put your eye out with almost anything, right? So we can't get hung up there and say that that's the stopping point. That's done a lot of damage. And we need to learn how to use these things responsibly. And, literally just put tools in the hands of children and teach them how to use them. And that's really, I think, the best way to really mature that frontal lobe so that those frontal lobes do the right thing and have some practice, really interacting with the real world. And some people are going to cut themselves. Some people are going to hurt themselves. I certainly did. I have a couple of scars. I was lucky, not everybody, can boast that, and bad things can happen. I think while those bad things can happen, I think what's worse is a world in which we don't permit those things to ever happen.
Absolutely. I had the BB gun and did not put my eye out. To that end, of giving young people those kind of opportunities that have been, from what I've seen, been largely taken away in school and at home, you're involved in the maker movement. And yes. Makerspaces. And that's something that I had really never run into until I met you. So can you tell us a little about that and how it works?
Well, it's an enormous world, and it runs from one extreme, which is people who are using technologies professionally. I mean, this is business-oriented. Some of what goes on in some of the bigger makerspaces may be business-oriented. It's these folks' businesses, and they're profiting from cohabitating a space and sharing equipment, sharing knowledge, or just sharing the economy of scale of these operations. The one up in Somerville in Boston is an example there where it's absolutely huge, and they have some very fine equipment, and if you're a member, you get to use this stuff. At the same facility, which is called the Artist Asylum, there are a lot of people who are more hobbyists and adventurers and co-collaborators and hangers-on and people who are just having fun being in a space like that. So it really runs the gamut, but it is a more formalized space.
So I join one of these spaces or one of these groups. What happens? What do I do? How does it work?
And that could range, like, I think if we're going to stick with that example, the Artist's Asylum, you could join on the level where now you just take classes. You just come and maybe take classes in 3D printing or AutoCAD or any number of things, which are based really on, it's sort of a commune, it's kind of a, what the curriculum is reflected upon the skill set of the people available to teach the classes. Or you could pay a little more money and actually have a certain number of square feet of essentially a cubicle, which has certain facilities. You'll get an electrical feed. There's Wi-Fi. It's an industrial height ceiling. And at that level, I'm not sure about how you access things like their laser cutters, their industrial milling machines. But you have access to the community. And then at another level that I can speak to a little bit more clearly is if you happen to have a piece of technology or equipment that you can add to this facility, you have a membership that comes with that. And the communal space then will take responsibility for the maintenance of your equipment and the safety of the equipment itself, and everyone has an organized way of accessing that and using that in some, you know, queue format where people stand in line and wait their turn to do their project and their pieces.
Would this be a good place, while we're talking about it, for AV companies with equipment to donate it?
Absolutely, 100%. This would be like, you know, throwing fresh meat into the lion's den. This is the kinds of inputs that these kinds of communities are going to thrive on. You would hope that there would be enough of a critical mass of these types of resources, and maybe yes and maybe not. These are not trivial in terms of the cost that associated with acquiring some of this stuff.
Is, you know, one of the things that I wrote that blog post about this week was the fact that we are not attracting enough young people, especially enough young women, to our industry, especially the technical end of things. Is the maker movement and maker spaces a way to bring younger people in? How young can you be and get involved in one of these things?
Well, I'm glad you bring up that aspect, because it is very, very interesting to be in one of these spaces and see that the social demographic, you know, we could slice and dice it different ways, but the diversity of people in these spaces is absolutely mind-boggling. The age ranges, you wouldn't look around and go, oh my God, this is just an all-male geek club. These are very vital spaces that are attracting such an enormous cross-section that it's really dizzying. You know, everybody you talk to has a different reason for being there and a different perspective on what they're doing.
How do spaces like, I mean, if one of the things as an industry that we want to do is to get more young people involved, especially in applied electronics, how do these places recruit? How do people find out about them?
Yeah, that's, one of the ways in their own community that they get the word out about Artist Asylum is they had a mini maker fair. They had a small fair on the street, all-day fair, that is a mini version of these maker fairs that Make Magazine sponsors. And that was, it provided a showcase. You know, it was basically like, look at what's happening. We're just going to take what we're doing, put it out in the street, and have everybody visit us. And after the fair, they sort of had a, you know, kind of an open house back at the makerspace, which is how I got introduced to that physical space, too.
I guess my question is, and you are one of my few educational customers, as I said. Most of my business has been corporate and military. What's up with kids today? What's the difference, really, in terms of I'm watching, you know, every student has an iPad, iPod, whatever. Mm-hmm. Do they, when I got something like that, the first thing I wanted to do was take it apart. Do they still?
No. You do not want to void your warranty.
I couldn't wait to void my warranty.
So, I mean, I don't know if we can ever really say that, here's what I'm trying to say. Press the rewind button, and here you are, it's 1964, and you're looking at your transistor radio or your germanium diode radio. There was a certain aspect I remember in that day and age of the idea that, you know, I'm going to build a Heathkit TV. It's going to be great. It's going to be less expensive, potentially better, than the TV that I could go out and buy. So there was always that vector. You know, if you did it yourself, you could do it better. You might be able to soup your car up. You might be able to do, you know, different things to different technologies that might be better than you could buy. Now, I think the sensibility today is largely that you could never at all approach the sophistication of what you can purchase. And yes, what you can purchase today, I mean, you know, there is no Heathkit, nor would there ever have been one imaginable, really, for something like a laptop, for instance, or a cell phone. You wouldn't build your own cell phone. Even, and this is kind of a little disappointing, a company out of New York, Adafruit, Lady Ada's company, one of the proponents and suppliers to the maker movement, brilliant lady, MIT graduate, and somebody I admire a lot, and her company produces a lot of kits. A disappointment is that they produced a kit that would allow you to build an iPod-like device. But they took it out of production because the iPod-like device was sad in comparison to an iPod and probably cost almost as much. But that's not the point.
It's not the point.
The point is that you touched all the pieces. You had to program some of the firmware. You had to put this thing together, and you touched all that stuff, and you understand how all the components work together.
Is this a place, I mean, what will be a hot topic in our industry, is this a place for distance education? Where if there aren't that many of those people to teach those things to kids, is this something where a teacher in the classroom without a whole lot of background in that could be the local hands while someone taught not just one class, but maybe three or four at a time mm-hmm. by video conference into that class?
Well, absolutely.
I guess the question there would be, I think that that kind of education requires a mentor. I mean, people have to be able to hold up their breadboard and say, what did I do wrong? And that's something that you can't get from YouTube. But yet, if what you're saying is true, and there aren't a lot of teachers in the classroom with that kind of background, could one guy with that kind of background serve an awful lot of classes
right.
by being that remote?
I certainly think so. I totally think that, actually, to give it a label and to talk about it in a way that might be more concrete, it would be like a virtual makerspace. You know,
I mean,
this is the idea behind a makerspace, that you can seek out this community. You can have somebody lean over your shoulder and say, well, there's your mistake. You know, we have the technology to do that. I have a very modest little webcam, and I can't believe the stuff that it can see if I put it right up to that circuit board. You could do the same on your end. I might see, you know, a cold solder joint, or, you know, it's very easy to put something in the wrong socket. And, you know, that could be the little springboard that you need. Insofar as that isn't the advantage that most people have, the language that we use when we're talking about these projects is, you know, be careful, make sure that this is, this is how to orient a chip before you put it in the socket. You know, it's a little bit of the Bob Vila approach.
Let me ask you one last question about this subject then. We looked at earlier when I was talking about the news, we talked about the fact that tablets now outselling notebooks and becoming only computers. Are we dumbing down, and do kids still want that kind of education?
Ooh, whoa, do kids want that kind of education? Yes, we're dumbing down. Do kids want that kind of education? Do kids want to eat food that is good for them? I don't think that education should ever abdicate the responsibility, the discipline, and the adult sense of purpose to the level of kids who just say, you know, hey, I don't feel like doing that today. I don't like that. That's boring. That is the sign of an uneducated mind. It is our job to create discipline and to create a space in which you can grow that mind to eventually understand why they want to do stuff that's not easy. Hard is good. It's, you know, it's, how is it worth the effort that you put into something? If it's, you know, if it was easy, everybody would do it, you know? We all want to invest our efforts and see them, you know, come to fruition and produce things. I mean, that's what making is an utterly human basic endeavor. Humans make things. We arguably can't even exist on the surface of this planet without the stuff we make. People don't just, you know, run around naked under the sun. Our environment is largely made by us, and increasingly in the future, I think that'll be the case. So the issue of whether, you know, do students get to, you know, whether they want that type of education, that's a very bad road to go down. We have to keep it clear. As educators, we have to understand what an education should be and to try to make that happen for every student to the best of our ability, to the best of that student's abilities. The reality is that we will keep going on this path of what you're calling dumbing down. Tablets, while there are some little examples, there certainly is the potential for much more to happen in this direction. But at this moment, if you're on a tablet, the prospects of you becoming a good programmer aren't that great. The best way I can see that happening would be a totally web-based programming environment where you're really not programming on the tablet anyway. You're just using it as a web device, and you're using your, you know, cloud-based web servers, and certainly that is brilliant. It's a wonderful thing. As a matter of fact, I can envision a whole computer programming course based on that. That isn't where we're really at, though. Largely, I think we're going to see the tablets in schools. The great big sucking sound of electronic textbooks is going to propel us enormously quickly into that space, because the textbook manufacturers have now clearly understood how they're going to sell us textbooks, and tablets are seen as the delivery for that, which I think is actually a very bad turn of events, because it kind of jumps right to a world in which the poorest of children just automatically have tablets? I don't think so. I hate to see a future in which the digital divide is made even worse. You know, your tablet's too old, or your tablet doesn't work anymore, or you never had a tablet, so you never got to read a book, or didn't have the same access to resources. And it's very typical of the way that the curve of these things go. It's not brilliant punditry to imagine that while things move in the direction of electronic publishing, which is probably great on some levels, because as has been brought up before, people who could never have gotten a critical mass, never had a publisher interested in their stuff, they'll be able to publish. That's great. On the other hand, if it means that good old-fashioned dead wood publishing, you walk into a library and there's nothing on the shelf, that will be tremendously detrimental to a certain population.
I think it will, too. I grew up in libraries. The library was, for me, it was just the wonderland where at 7 years old I got a library card and I walked in the front door and saw all those books and was like, you mean I can really take any of these home that I want to? That was a great moment for me. And my wife's heavily involved in Friends of the Library and trying to preserve the library, not just as a space for deadwood books, but as a space for learning and coming together, much like the maker spaces that you've talked about today. You know, with the ebook thing, you bring up a whole nother subject that for which we were going to do a whole nother podcast, and I'd like to ask you to come back and do that with me. Anyway, Bill, we're out of time. Thanks very much for being with us today, and definitely would love to have you back soon to talk about that whole ebook tablet.
Thank you.
Thanks.